I'm actually going to talk today primarily as a researcher, as someone who's done a lot of work related to publication issues and authorship. I've done research related to looking at internal documents from the pharmaceutical and tobacco industries that have been released as part of litigation. And these documents have revealed a lot about some of these authorship issues, as well as other things. So I think the first question here is, what is a ghost author? This is a quote from an internal pharmaceutical industry document, and I think that I love to use this to define a ghost author, because basically it's someone who provides substantial assistance in writing a paper. And in this quote, so this is someone who's being commissioned by a medical education company, MECC, and this company is going to offer substantial assistance to this ghost author to develop the manuscript, which includes doing an extensive literature search, submitting selected articles to him for reference, offering help in identifying and collecting his cases, analyzing the data, writing the manuscript, and anything else he needs. And as I often say, my co-authors don't even do that much work sometimes on a paper. So, you know, so this is a lot of work. So this is someone who's going to get paid, in this case, $5,000 to put their name on a paper, and they're being offered all of that assistance. They haven't written it. So I guess the real take-home message I want to give about ghost authorship here is it's not just writing the paper. I think it could be a lot more than writing a paper. It can also be having a study created for you and then having someone put their name on that study. So to illustrate that point, I want to show you some examples from internal tobacco industry documents that are just a great example of how a study was manufactured with ghost and guest authors. And we've published this study in the BMJ, actually, so if anyone wants the full details, I'm just hitting the highlights here. But there was a very, very influential study published by a Japanese researcher in 1981 named Hirayama. This is the most cited study ever on the adverse health effects of secondhand smoke, and it serves as a basis for a lot of regulation about secondhand smoke. So incredibly influential study. So the tobacco industry in their internal documents laid out a plan to basically create a study that would refute this Hirayama study. They wanted something in the scientific literature that they could cite to say the Hirayama study's results about secondhand smoke are unfounded. So they felt it was very important to have a study conducted in Japan because that's where this study was conducted. They wanted a similar epidemiological setting. So they wanted a Japanese study, as they called it in their documents. So here's two quotes from high-level tobacco industry executives. And the first one talks about how a Dr. Chris Proctor should supervise the work, but his presence should be low-key and not appear in any of the publications, particularly since this is a Japanese study. Now, Chris Proctor is British, and he works for the tobacco industry, and he's definitely not Japanese. So the second quote says that Proctor and his fee, so he's getting paid for this, may be necessary to help get this done, but again, it should be a Japanese study, and Proctor should not be a co-author on any publication that comes out of it. So basically, this person, Chris Proctor, is in charge of directing the study, but from the very beginning, it's planned that he will not be an author. So that's a ghost author. So who should design and conduct the study? So we're not talking about just writing it. We're talking about everything else that goes on. So this is, again, a quote from an internal document, and it describes how project management would be done by Covington & Burling, which happens to be a law firm. So they're going to manage the project. And the project managers would remain remote from any scientific publications, and two Japanese scientists will be the principal investigators. So this is actually where guest authors come in, because two Japanese scientists would be the named authors on the paper, but they're really not going to be doing anything here. So what happens? Very interestingly, in the internal tobacco documents, you can find every draft of this paper. Every draft that was submitted in every draft that was rejected, and then the next submission and the next rejection. It's very depressing. It's like when I submit. But you find them all in these in the documents. But what you also notice here is that the authorship changes. So in draft one, we have the guest authors. In draft two, we still have the guest authors, but now we have one of the formerly ghost authors appear. And in drafts 3 to 7, the guest authors are gone. And Christopher Proctor, who of course was behind all of this, never appears. So he is the ghost author. So what happened? This is what got published. Peter Lee is the only author. It does acknowledge there, I gratefully acknowledge financial support from several tobacco companies, and I acknowledge the help of the Japanese investigators. And I show this acknowledgement because I think it is so, so important to realize that disclosure and acknowledgement just does not tell you the full story of what went on with this paper at all. So you would think, okay, the tobacco industry funded it, so what, big deal. But, I mean, they actually did everything here. So, you know, the question here is, are journal policies sufficient? You know, what can you do to prevent this from happening? A paper gets submitted to you, it has authors on it, you know, what do you do? So we did another study, again based on internal documents, but this time from the pharmaceutical industry, to try to determine if when a ghostwritten article is targeted for a certain journal, was it more likely to get published if that journal had weaker policies? That's what we wanted to know. So basically, we looked at some proposals, two proposals from drug industry documents related to a drug named gabapentin. And what these proposals are here is they outline a series of planned ghostwritten articles. And this little program of work was going to cost $160,000 approximately, which would be paid to these authors. So these two proposals had a total of 24 planned ghostwritten publications. 11 of them, we could never find a record that they were published, so not a huge success rate. Of the ones that were published, 6 wound up in the journals that were originally targeted, and 7 wound up published in a different journal. And then we looked at what was disclosed, and as you can see, basically, almost none of them disclosed that these even had funding from Park Davis, which was the company that was providing the funding for these ghostwritten articles. So basically, we wanted to know, for the ones that didn't get published where they were supposed to, did those journals have stricter policies? Is that why they weren't getting published in the target journal? So a small sample, descriptive study. So, and again, you know, these are older, but we needed to allow, this is the time frame in the documents, and so just focus on that for a second. So where the first column shows where the proposed articles, they got published where they were targeted. And you can see that it's none of them had explicit disclosures for funding for ghostwriting. They had slightly less explicit criteria for authorship or conflict of interest policies. Too small a sample to be statistically significant. We did follow up through 2010 to see if these journals had changed their policies, and some of them actually now have sort of shifted to having a stricter policy, but it's still far from 100%. But basically what we were trying to determine was, you know, is there variability in the policies, and was that associated with publication? And it seemed like it was. They were a little more successful when the journal had a weak policy. So we had to make a qualitative judgment about what was a weak and a strong policy, so I'm going to show you some examples. So this is an example from Pharmacotherapy, was one of the targeted journals that actually had a very strict ghostwriting policy. So here it is. You had to check a box if you were an author that says very explicitly the paper has been ghostwritten by an individual sponsored by a pharmaceutical, biotechnology, or medical company. So that's pretty explicit. We would call that a strong policy. This is another example that we defined as a strong policy, where it said professional writers employed by pharmaceutical companies or other academic or government or commercial entities who have drafted or revised the paper must be included as authors. So it's just saying if you're involved in the writing, you had to be identified as an author. Again, I think ghost authorship is a lot more than just writing in some cases. So we really, it might not account for that. This is kind of what we viewed as a moderate policy. It says that sponsors' roles must be described, data acquisition, interpretation of data, writing and revising the manuscript. You know, the author had to have a role in that, but it's kind of fuzzy. This we thought was weak, which is saying I have participated sufficiently in the conception, design, analysis, and writing to be an author. We think that's a very kind of value-laden comment. And then for some journals that had no policies that we could find in writing, we actually interviewed all the editors of all the journals at the time when these proposals were submitted. And these were a couple of the journals that had no published policy. And the editors said, no, not really. We took people at their word. And then another we asked, do you have any procedures to verify the truthfulness and completeness of authorship? And this was in 2009. No, we rely on the integrity of the authors. So these were journals where there was no written policy. So some of you may have seen this recent article by Alistair Matheson, and I really like this article, actually, and I think it's very much in line with the conclusions of the study I just showed you, which is talking about the ICMJE requirements, which he calls the triple lock formula. And basically, the conclusion of this article is that these criteria can be manipulated by the pharmaceutical industries and others to get people qualified for authorship or not, depending on what you want to do. And whenever I look at these, as someone who does survey research, whenever you have a question that has a lot of ors and ands, it immediately introduces some problems in survey research. So that's what makes it very easy here to sort of work these criteria the way you want them, because there's a lot of ors and ands. So the take-home point so far is ghost authorship can be a lot more than just writing the paper and not getting your name on it. Disclosure of the role of people in authors probably isn't enough, although it's by far the most commonly used management strategy for conflicts of interest. I've written reams on this. Does it protect against bias? No, because much of the research we've done to show that there's a bias related to a particular conflict of interest is based on the fact that that conflict was disclosed in the first place, so it doesn't eliminate bias. And in fact, in the economic literature, we find that when people disclose particular biases, it actually makes them more biased in terms of the advice they give. So that's why it's kind of necessary but not sufficient, in my view, to have disclosures. And then the other big issue is, can you even trust them? As you know, we've learned more and more from internal documents and other internal sources. We're not even sure we can trust disclosures. And then the last issue is they've kind of become a parody or a mockery for some people. And I tend to collect these crazy disclosures from my fellows. And one of my fellows sent me this labeled on the email, best disclosure ever. And it's very long, so I apologize, but it's just an outrageous disclosure, and it has a lot of dots in it, so it's actually about as twice as long as that. And this is a real journal. It's a peer-reviewed journal, and the authors are saying that their disclosure is that they're interested in encouraging harm reduction, but that they also have other conflicts of interest, which some people would consider to be only the real conflicts of interest, related to money. They got money from the tobacco industry to do the study. Then they go on to say the grantor is unaware of this study, which I found really amazing. How could someone give you funding if they're not even aware that they're giving it to you? I guess they mean the grantor did not have a role in the study. Then they go on and on about their own personal beliefs, and though they say though these do and might respectively represent interest and credibly influence what research we consider important, it is not clear how these interests might be seen as justifying the knee-jerk accusation of bias. So, I mean, this really got published. And many, many years ago, I wrote a paper which actually never got accepted anywhere on how we should have structured reporting of disclosures, just like we have structured reporting of abstracts. And we have come, for many journals, a long way to that. But I think this statement is a great example for why we should have structured reporting of disclosure statements.